Welcome to the Tenet Podcast. I'm Todd Pearson, here with my friend and partner in crime, Wes Brown.
Hey, everybody. I'm in rare form tonight. Can't wait. It's a Monday night, but we're in rare form. So it's
good to see you, Todd. Been drinking.
I don't drink, dude.
I know.
I don't need to get high.
But you can't. You
I'm
can't
high
even,
in life.
You can't even get the words out of your mouth.
I know. I slur anyway. I think I had a stroke.
This is why I love hanging out with you, man.
It's good to see you, though. I'm looking forward.
It's good to see
this
you, too.
Fun. Yep.
We've already had a good conversation. We've already been on for almost an hour talking via Zoom.
That's right.
All if our right, wives buddy. Were here, they'd be giving us grief.
Oof.
You talk to him all the time. Anyway, we're here to talk about art, right?
We are.
We are.
Fine art.
This week on the program, we bring you an incredibly talented artist that's on an upward trajectory. She produces stunning work with a keen intellect. Her newest body of work is entitled Bend the Iron. Welcome to the program, A.L. Lummis. Amy, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. It's good to see you. I feel like I just saw you.
You did, but not your whole face. Just
I was masked.
Just the top half, yes.
And I didn't have a cool mask like you did.
That was pretty neat, huh? That was like the Darth Vader thing. It's just this plastic piece, Wes, that goes over my nose and around my ears. So because I'm a big mouth talker, so I eat my mask just about every other word.
So you wear a face shield.
I was last night because that would have been the one thing that would have driven me absolutely off the wall. Besides having to run a sign up and having to, you know, push sales to, it was just, that is what it is. That's art and COVID, but that would have driven me nuts. So I got a Darth Vader shield, just, and then I also, you know, I just smoking all night so I could go, no, that's not true at all.
Well, I would have appreciated the face shield if I was there last night to your opening, because I rely a lot more on reading lips than I thought I did. So not that I'm hard of hearing, but I do have tinnitus. So when people wear face masks, I have to like really work at listening because I read lips evidently. Didn't even know I could
maybe
do that.
Maybe I do too. I have a really hard time hearing anybody with anything, but maybe I often think that's because I'm just having my own conversation in my head. And I'm not paying enough attention. So maybe that's my problem too. I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what's going on. It's not me just not paying attention.
And don't say that you're having a conversation in your head, because then it sounds like you should be on medication.
Well, okay. All right. Sure.
Just kidding. Well, it's good to meet you. We've heard your name more than once. We're really excited to have you on the show. So thanks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be, I guess, in my art studio, but also with you.
Thanks.
So talk about this pop-up show that you did yesterday evening, Amy.
Okay.
How did that come about? We're just going to jump into that since we've already talked about seeing you in the past 24 hours.
Okay. Do you mean like the synthesis of the work, or do you mean just, I guess, the coming together and putting it in that place?
No, coming together and putting it in that place.
Okay. So I met Andrew, who owns the photography studio that we were in, at an event. I was working because occasionally I'll do body paint or face paint. For this particular thing, was this. I was working at a party to do body paint for Halloween. So we were doing squealy, elaborate skull faces, really spooky stuff. It was exciting. And upon speaking to Andrew, he mentioned that occasionally he will have artists come through his art or his photography studio, hang work, and have a few friends come by and, you know, see if they can't generate some interest. And it's a beautiful space. I mean, it truly is stunning. So when he approached me, he said, I've seen your work. I'd love to talk more about it. I went to the studio, we chatted. He said, I have a real vision in mind for what I'd like to see for you. And that was something in and around 50 pieces, lots of pencil work, because, you know, that tends to be more of a viable thing for most folks. And then, you know, some big Hallmark pieces for me and the stuff that I really enjoy doing. With that, I knew I needed to do a deep dive into something. And I had had this vision of my son at the Colorado Railroad Museum. And he was, at the time, he was, I think, 3 or 4. Yeah, maybe 4. But he had this, it was one of those intense moments where I saw him approaching a behemoth of a train. And it was a retired train, but it was on the tracks. And he approached it and he just was so vulnerable and small, and but he was fascinated. And that relationship was in my head and it had kind of been stewing and it had been there for, God, at that point, about a year and a half. And I had discussed a vision for a piece, just one, that would look like, you know, him kind of facing off to the train. And when Andrew approached me with this kind of large scale, this idea with maybe several pieces, sketches, this, that, the other, I thought, why not? Let's dive deep into the trains. Let's see what happens. Because it's very approachable. Oddly enough, you know, young boys attach a lot to trains, but so do young women. You know, I really didn't even know until I started diving more and more deeply into this that I find women are also very attracted to these, you know, massive hulking beasts. And you know, and there's always the metaphor of like Anna Karenina and, you know, that, those kinds of things. So that was how that came about. Andrew and I had planned to do it. I believe initially it was going to be April 21st. We had a banjo player lined up, you know, going to be playing music. I was going to read not only my artist statement, but some poetry, talk a little bit about what the series meant to me and so forth. And then, you know, hopefully the idea was not only promote my work, but, you know, move the work, move the pieces, and also get some pretty heavy hitting curators in there to, you know, generate some interest in furthering my representation as well. So that was what it was going to be. Then COVID. So what we did was kind of scrapped it until we felt like maybe this could happen. And then around October, Andrew said, let's try to figure this out. And we came up with a date, but as it were, things started shutting down again. So we had to, you know, create a sign up, and we were really strict about everything, but you know, it worked. It worked okay. It wasn't my best attended event, but for what it was, I think it was fabulous. So
I think it was too. It was really nicely put together and thought out. Not only that, but it was intimate and very enjoyable experience, despite the fact that we're in this weird scenario. And I think, like we discussed last night, if this show had happened a month ago, it would have been very well attended. But I think because everything is ramped up in the last couple weeks, you know, maybe people thought twice about coming out. I don't know. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I cannot even quantify how many people either A, said, I'm just too nervous, or B, canceled 48 hours before saying, this is just too scary, or, you know, but that's okay. At this point in with the culture and the state of everything as it is, I'm kind of in the zone of saying, whatever feels right to you, you do that. And if that feels right, as long as you're not hurting anybody, I'm not going to hurt anybody. So you do you, I'm going to do me. As long as you're not hurting anybody, if you don't feel like you're safe, if you feel like that's too stressful for you, then go with God. Like, just you do it. That's fine. So yeah, I do feel like it would have been better attended, but at the same time, yeah, bygones be bygones. Let it go. Now we can move on. Now we can start fresh and think clearer, and that box is checked. So,
well, and plus it's nice to see all that work up in one space at one time.
Yes. Yes, it is.
There's something about seeing all your work up. You see it all the time as you're producing it, and you see it sitting around your studio, but
yeah.
Seeing it all up on, you know, the walls, is it's a whole different ball of wax.
Right. Absolutely. And it's funny too, because the women who model for me often, like, you know, they see it they'll show, but when they see themselves in those moments, oh my God, I'm amazing. You know, it's like, it does. It's an incredibly edifying thing as an artist to be able to see that kind of culmination of your work and to know that it's worthy of that wall. I think we talk about wall space a lot, but wall worthiness should also be, you know, something spoken of, and it felt very good to feel very wall worthy in that moment. So, yeah.
So because it was a pop-up event, was it just one night or a couple nights, or how long is the show?
Pop-ups, usually they can be like 24 to 48 hours. And typically what I do is I try to do one of these once a year because, although I usually have some kind of show going on at least once a month, maybe once every other month, depending, but, you know, I'll have one piece in one show, one piece over here, one piece over here. The big show I'll have is usually with Bit Factory Gallery in the Denver Arts District. And then I'll do one pop-up show a year. And the nice thing about the pop-up show is obviously you're not paying the gallery's percentage for your sales. So either you're moving stuff that didn't move through the year, or you've come up with something unique for that specific show. But the idea is make me a deal, you know, like let's get scrappy. Let's tear it up. You know, you know, I want first and foremost the work to resonate. And if something speaks to someone, I would rather move that painting to someone that, you know, can see it and finds an answer to a question they didn't know they were asking, rather than just somebody who collects and wants resale, you know. And there are those collectors, you know, somebody who's just buying time until you get more famous, and then they'll sell it to the next guy, and they'll sell it to the next guy, you know. So I'd much rather wheel and deal and attempt to find an authentic buyer who truly feels something for the work, that I'm sharing this with them, they're sharing, you know, something with me.
Yeah. So the gallery doesn't necessarily take a commission on pop-up events.
No. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's why we call them like a pop-up, because you pay for the space essentially. Okay. So that's, or you have somebody who's kind enough to loan you a space. Yeah. So that's also something that happens, but yeah. So I don't usually do more than one a year, because again, it's a lot to put together. All the overhead is on you. And typically with these things, you know, we have snacks and we have more drinks and we have, you know, big. And this particular event was supposed to have been catered, and, you know, all of this, like, we had this grand vision of something spectacular. That being said, you know, I think what you want also is to build the experience. Like, you want even your pop-up show to feel museum quality. And I think I will never be somebody who will, you know, just like throw the work in the front yard and, hey, like, hey, friends and family, come support me or whatever. You know, I want a true experience. I want something that people walk away feeling, wow, I've not only like learned a lot about this artist, I've learned something about myself. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I intended a great party, you know, and at the end of the day, that's what it's about. You just want somebody to walk away feeling completely excited and just overwhelmed by what they are feeling. So, yeah.
It was an exciting show for sure. I felt the excitement last night, and it was good to get out on a Sunday night and go see some phenomenal art.
Thank you.
It doesn't get any better than that in my book. So,
well, that was a tricky thing too, because we were trying to figure out what days to do it and looking at the weather, and we took a gamble. The weather was supposed to be good, and so that's why we went with that day. And it was phenomenal, really. Like, it was, we had the doors open all day until about 6. So, yeah.
So you're a Colorado native, correct?
Mostly. I came here when I was 3. So yes. Okay. Yes and no. I mean, I wasn't born here. I moved here from California in the 80s, like everybody else. And yeah, but I've grown up here, yeah, since I was 3 years old.
Were you always a creative person?
I think genetically, it's it's a genetic build. So my parents were both actors, and that's how they met. So they were both pursuing their art and their passion, and they met on the acting circuit, and they moved to Los Angeles in order to pursue their careers, and had, you know, some babies, and then decided, I had a great grandmother who lived here in Colorado. So they decided to be closer to her because she was you know, going to help out with us. And so that's where the creative parts, I think, lie. But the beauty of the way I was brought up was that nothing is impossible. It, you know, you ask my mom today if there's mermaids and she'll say, it's not impossible, you know, but I love that. And upon further research, you know, when you're raising your own kids, and I really enjoy neuroscience and how it relates to art, but I really love the idea of the neuron tree. And at about 6 and 7 years old, your neuron tree starts automatically trimming on what's possible and what's not possible. But you look at someone like, for instance, Elon Musk, and if magic is possible, then that neuron tree stays huge. The infinitude is possible. You know, it's gigantic. So if you are raised in a household with anything is possible, magic, science, air, you know, it's one of my mom's best sayings is, what color does the air smell today? You know, it's like, both of my parents were, you know, they're larger than life. They gave us a soft place to land, but also cultivated a sense of responsibility with your art. You know, you make sure you do this for a purpose. Make sure this is bringing you joy. Make sure you're authentic to your craft, as well as make sure that, you know, you're leaving the world with something good. And yeah, we grew up very creative, but I think for a purpose, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting, you know, coming from a family with actors, that they're not going to squash any dreams. They're going to let you like explore anything, because, yeah, you know, whether they, maybe their parents squashed them and didn't want them to do what they wanted, or they had the same experience. But when you come from a family that, you know, has expectations of like, well, you're going to go to college and you're going to get a business degree and you're going to come back and run the business, you can really squash the creativity, or, you know, sure, you'll never make a living doing art. But being from a family that of artists, that's really cool, because it's, you know, all they do is cultivate that for you.
Sure. Absolutely. And I mean, they didn't always, you know, act, and they eventually got, you know, like big kid jobs and so forth. But that, I think, instilling that idea that anything is possible, you have to be smart enough and accountable enough to find a way to do it. I think too, I hear this often, somebody will say something like, oh, I loved art when I was a kid, but my parents wanted me to make money. That just feels like silly to me. You know, if you're smart enough, you can be successful at anything. You just have to find the path, right? And that takes that neuron tree being gigantic and huge. If anything is possible, take over the world, right?
Yep.
It's great that you had that growing up. And I think a lot of people, like you said, Wes, they kind of quash that and try to be a little bit more pragmatic or what have you. And I think it's interesting that you chose you could have very easily fell into the whole acting thing, I imagine, but instead you figured out your own path and have done your own thing. Are any of your siblings actors?
No, my sister is an incredible singer, but she's also a little more of an analytical thinker. So she really, she has near of a photographic memory. I mean, she speaks Spanish. She took it in high school, you know, like that's the level of that kind of intelligence. But, you know, I think there's also the deep thinkers, like, you know, so nobody else really acts, but Luke likes to joke whenever it's alumnus gathering, it's like, everybody wants attention. he said, it's so hard to keep up with who's on stage in the moment, you know, like, we're all, and it's funny because, you know, we're so accommodating. It's like, everybody must have their own voice, you know? So yeah, we're all, it's a free for all, but Rebecca's amazing and talented in what she does. And she does more of a grown up job stuff now, but she's in the medical field, but still an incredibly creative thinker. And still, again, you know, anything is possible. And I think that that's too what she always brings to the table. You know, I love when she'll come to me and her adopted teenage son would want, you know, I want Air Jordans. Well, those are almost $200, Robert. But it was never no. It was like, okay, we'll find a way. You know, we'll find a way. There's just never no. There's never no. So.
So where do you fall in line with your siblings?
So I have just an older sister, and she's 5 years older, but she lives here in Colorado and she lives in Fort Collins.
With that much time between children, I think each child gets the opportunity to be their own person. If you had a bunch of siblings and you were all close in age, I think sometimes people get lost in the shuffle, but being 5 years, you know, your sister, younger than your sister, you kind of had your own thing going on, and you were far enough away from her. You were never probably compared to her, I imagine, when you were going through school.
And we were very different. we're kind of, if you morphed the two of us, I think you'd have the most powerful superhero ever. Right. Because I feel like there's a lot of creation on this side and there's a lot of analytics on this side, but bring the forces together and amazing things happen, you know, but, yeah. And she's always who I go to when I have anything to figure out and whatever. But yes, we did. We got to shine. We had our own spotlights. So
outside of your parents being very influential, was there anybody else in your life? Did you have like teachers that were very like, hey, you should, you know, really think about pursuing this as a career? Was there anybody like that in your life that was like kind of pushing you in the direction of art? Or was it just strictly like, hey, your parents are kind of letting you do your thing and you decided on this path and this is what you're going to do?
Yes, actually. So several, and I'll get through it as quickly as possible. First of all, again, never say die. My mom knew I wanted to do art. In lieu of, you know, she didn't really know quite how to go about private lessons, but I was always very disappointed with public art. And we can dive deeper into that later. But so in lieu of me being kind of unhappy with that and trying to make, you know, square fit into a circle, we would go to local art shows and she'd say, pick. And we do this once a year. And I grew up in Louisville. So Louisville has like an art show in one of their whatever. And she'd just say, pick. And I'd go through and I find the painting or piece I love the most. And she would contact that local artist and say, hey, my daughter's ready to sweep your studio. She's ready to stretch your canvas. She's ready to babysit your kids, but she needs to know about art. This is what she's doing with her life. And I've said I was going to be an artist since I was 2 years old. She says, I said when I was two, I was like, I'm going to be an artist when I grow up, you know, and it never ended. It never stopped. That never stopped. So she did that. That being said, there's some notable names, local artists, one being Gina Blickenstaff. She's, I believe, still working in Boulder. She was monumentally influential. I was in high school. I was in a time in my life where people encouraged my physical beauty as something more interesting than my brain. And she was a teacher that said, how dare you? Not in a mean way, but you know, there's too much going on here for you to let that be your narrative. So massively influential there as far as art teachers. As far as teachers go, again, I had two teachers in middle school, Heather Gardner and Ginny Vigilic. And it's amazing to me how much those two women, especially Ginny Vigilic, because I was at a very formidable moment in my life when she and I met, and how her approach to feminism, her approach to language, her approach to everything, her entire life, her accountability informed so much of who I am now. So if she ever gets to hear this, hey, Jenny. Kung Kung Kachu later on down the road. I didn't even take art in high school. I was over it. At that point, public art education was a no-go for me. So much so I had terrible grades in those classes. And I battled teachers on what I wanted my vision to be for a project. And they said, no, that's not the assignment, you know? And it was like, but this is my vision. This is what I'm saying to the world. So why can't we get there together? And instead of just saying, hey, this is a kid who's deeply passionate, you know, it was follow my work, follow my syllabus, where that can be good and that can't be good, you know? So later as a freshman in college, one of my like first professors, he was just a master's student at the time, but initially I had wanted to go into graphic design, and he said, why are you doing graphic design? I said, well, you know, it's a fallback. He said, you're one of the best fine artists I've ever seen come through here. What are you doing? And he said, what makes you think you can't be as successful as a fine artist as you could be as a digital artist or as a graphic designer? And I was like, oh yeah, you're right. Absolutely. That's absolutely what I should be doing. So I went through and got my degree in fine art. That being said, one of my painting professors gave me like a very deeply seminal moment in my life when she was awful. She challenged me at every corner. She was cruel when it was unnecessary. She was a, you know, where I say like some teachers are winds beneath your wings, and she was a hunter with a shotgun. She's just like out there like, nope, nope. But if it weren't for that, I don't know if I would be a full-time artist today, because to this day, I'm still middle fingers in the air saying like, you bet I'm gonna do it. Just watch me, you know? So I guess those people, kind of, yeah, they really did inform that experience and becoming a full-time artist. And, you know, of course it took years of doing things on the side, like taking pictures for an auto magazine while I'm still trying to get gallery representation and still trying to raise my kid, and, you know, or you know, nannying and whatever. But this was all in service to my art. And I think amidst all this, I decided I wanted to, you know, have children, raise a family, all of that. And then, you know, divorce and so forth. But all of this, I think at the end of the day that there isn't other options for me. I'm not going to be good at anything else. So thank God to those amazing educators that gave me that scaffolding, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
Because if it weren't for them, yeah.
Where did you go to college?
UNC in Greeley.
Okay.
All right. Of all places. I loved it. It doesn't get a good enough reputation. Go to UNC artists. Outside of that one lady where she who shall not be named, but they're fantastic. And what was amazing to me too, was that it was intimate, you know? I was there with the other art students, and it was us, and it was us against the world. And we got to know each other, and we're in every class together, and we see each other, and we challenge each other's process, and we challenge each other's, you know, everything. And then, you know, you get shit faced on the weekends, and that, you know, and we're there together too. And that kind of camaraderie and that kind of binding of creativity, it really does make or break your experience in college. So I loved UNC. So,
yeah. So the teacher that challenged you and pushed you, I think that's a dangerous game that some teachers play, and it works out really, and we've talked about this before, but it works out well for some people, but other people's it'll absolutely crush. So it's interesting that you kind of rose up and, you know, middle fingers, you know, flying, pushed through. But I could see where other people would just be totally crushed by that and throw in the towel.
Let me put it this way. I received 2 D's from her. I am the only full-time artist that I know out of UNC at all. I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure they exist. I know they exist. They've got to exist. Yeah. And I had D's. I was graduating with D's, with could work. I was selling the work. I was moving the work at art auctions and, you know, fundraisers and that sort of thing. I was moving the work and, and I was getting D's on it. But, you know, hey, middle fingers in the air, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you persevered.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, was she harsh to everybody like that? Or did you feel like it was...
Well, let's just say she wasn't a favorite. So Luke, my fiance, he also had her, and we were in their core classes, I think three of them together. He also has nothing favorable to say, but he will argue kind of that, like, the same thing, that like she was one of those people that, you know, compounded his passion for teaching right, doing this the right way, you know, not doing this the way that Hunter with a shotgun, right? You know, that you can teach artistically and you can change a person's entire narrative when you give them that license for creativity. You know, and I think that that's, I mean, we all try to do that, right? As parents, as aunts, as uncles, as just good community members, your thoughts are important. Your feelings are important. You're important. And so is everybody else, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you can like instill that with these creative outlets, that's what we want, you know, because nobody's going to be happy if they're just sitting in their house like, I have this job. What else is there to do? I guess television, you know, what that's a meaningless life. So, you know, you want to have the way to escape and feel happy and vent. And if we can have that, then it takes sometimes somebody teaching you, you know, how to throw a pot or how to sketch or whatever.
Yeah.
Did I go down a rabbit hole just then?
No.
Not okay. At all.
I forgot the question.
So. No, you answered it. So,
yeah. Do you think she believed in what she was doing, or do you think she was maybe just a pissed off, bitter person that was really unhappy where she was?
I think the latter, probably. Let's hope, though, that, you know, with experiences like students like me, because I wasn't the only one. That she's found some direction. But yeah, I think, and that's okay too. And that's a hard thing that I've had to come to terms with, is that this game is brutal to women. It is brutal to women. And the art game being. And I think that several females, you know, go that route. Cause you know, you do, you have to pay bills. You gotta put the food on the table. So if education was her fallback, that I could see why somebody might not enjoy somebody who is deeply passionate, going to make this my life, I'm going to be a full-time artist out of the, you know, and where, whatever, I think that that's probably something to do with it, but yeah, let's hope the best for her. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Most definitely. Absolutely.
So you graduate from college and you do a multitude of things. You went full time in 2014. Is that what I read?
I did. Yep. After I had my son, it was kind of at that point I had two children and I said, you know, what does this really look like? And, you know, do I continue to attempt, you know, side jobs, or would my time be better spent? Because, you know, at that point your time is so precious, you know, and pardon, we can all say that, but I think until you're dividing it between two children and dividing it between this and that and the other, but when your career is about how much passion you're willing to put into something, it's, you know, if time is that precious, you need to, you use it more wisely. So, you know, whereas like, you know, some people like put the kids to bed and they would turn on a TV show, you know, I'm putting the kids to bed and then I'm working for another 2 hours. And then, you know, I'm getting up early and I'm working out. And then I, you know, and then I just emailing, I'm doing this, I'm trying to, I'm following leads. I'm asking for, you know, emailing curators, trying to eat all of that. But every single second is so precious, because the ones that you are spending with your family are also precious, but you don't want to waste any of them. So I honestly do have my kids to thank also for giving me a further fire for what I'm doing. And if it weren't for them, I'd be useless human. I really feel like at the end of the day, if it weren't for them, I'd just be floating around painting pictures, you know, but I look at their little beautiful vases, and if they can't take me seriously, then who can? And I got to bring the fire for them, right? So
yeah, you rock.
I don't know.
We had we kind of discussed this last night, and you actually have three kids, correct?
I do. Yeah.
10 and under. And so here's the difference between males and females. You are an artist and you are a mom. You are both.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to being a mom, there's all these things that moms do. Now, if it's a male and you're a dad and an artist, well, you kind of get a pass, I feel, even in modern day society, right?
I mean, I don't want to speak to every single
but I'm yeah. serious. If I'm creating my art, you know, my focus is on my art as a man, I think 9 times out of 10,
mm-hmm.
and it falls back to his wife or his partner,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
they take care of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Moms that are artists, and we've talked to more than one mom that's, you know, more than one artist that's a mom.
Sure.
There's this balancing act that goes on, and you're mm-hmm. just as invested in being a mother as you are at being an artist.
Absolutely. You know? Oh yeah, absolutely. And you have to check yourself every single second of the day that you're not, you know, we spoke about this last night, but I love this turn of phrase of where does your service lie? Where's your service line? If your eyes are on the prize, then that's okay. You know, do whatever this is. Or do whatever this is. But sometimes that means laundry's not done, or this isn't happening, or that's not happening, or, you know, whatever. But somebody has to create this path, because I just don't see it. I just haven't seen it. It was so hard being a solo mom with three kids and doing art full time. It was so hard. It was 4 hours of sleep a night. It was crying and waking up in the middle of the night. How am I going to pay these bills? What's happening? It was so scary. But somebody has to do it. I don't feel like martyrdom is right, you know, but at the same time, you need to be accountable for the work you're creating and the imprint you're leaving. And like I said, if I can't look at these kids and say, like, I did everything I could to be that person, so your place is better in the world, then yeah, I have to do that. So, yes, it is a weird balancing act, but it's going to be easier soon, you know, with every human being, like the other artists that you spoke to and that are also mothers, and with us, when we can say to those kids, it's mommy's time to, we need to create, you know, and you need to do, you know, you need to go create, or you need to go do something, or you need to go outside, or you know, that's you be responsible for that now. And like, and now that my kids have that idea that we have to respect mommy's time of her job, and her job is cool, and her job is fun, and her job is exciting, you know, it's paints and it's cool, and but that's her job. Yeah, I think now that that's being built into them and being instilled in them. And I think that hopefully, you know, give it a few years, I'll come around and it'll all be good. And everybody will be on the even playing field. And even if you're solo with a few kids and, you know, all that, it'll be easy peasy, you know, God willing.
I think part of what Todd was talking about is, you know, it's really a cultural thing. You know, we've had generation upon generation of expectations that the men is the breadwinner, the women stay at home and take care of the kids. And so there's that. And then when you have, you know, a push in the 70s and 80s where, you know, divorce is accepted and there's a lot of single parents, then there's a lot of, you know, a lot of onus is put on the woman to still be the, you know, the child raiser, for lack of a bad word, but still expected to raise the children. And now you're forced to actually work full time and try to make ends meet and put food on the table and pay all the bills. And, you know, I think some things are changing, because I know a handful of dads that, you know, they have a career, but it takes second fiddle to their kids. They, you know, I have a friend who's a photographer, and it's all about his son. he works when he has to, but everything revolves around his son.
Yeah.
So I think there's some changes, but yeah, there's a lot of onus put on women, especially if they want to be professional.
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak to, if you'll notice, I'm kind of skirting this because I don't want to whine. I feel like that is something I want to, I told myself when I was going to speak to you guys, I'm not going to whine. But deeply, deeply do I feel that the narrative in our society is that a good woman is a martyr, and that has to end somewhere. We don't sacrifice and femininity shouldn't be in the same breath. That shouldn't be the, you know, Western world's idea of what good, a good woman is, a good mother is. A good mother is so much. And if a good mother is, you know, going on business trips 5 days a week and, you know, seeing her kids a few hours on the weekends and, you know, providing so dad's home all that time and all of that. If I said that to some people, they'd say, no, that's not a good mother. But why is it a good father if it's that, you know? So yes, you are absolutely correct. I deeply agree. The narrative is changing and society's views are changing. And I see it more and more often. And I read about this, and feminism it is my life. It is my blood. And I always say, it's my God. Like I really, equality for all women is something that I will never stop. It informs my work. It informs my parenting. It informs everything, but something I'm very passionate about. But again, I will not whine about where I am, because I don't want that to be what defines me. I hope that if by overcoming odds, discussing odds, but maybe not plights, that we transcend that and things change, right?
Hopefully. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's switch a little.
Go ahead.
No, I want you to finish the conversation, but I want to take a pivot when you're ready.
Okay. So, you know, when you told me last night that you had, that you have three children all under the age of 10 or 10 and under, and you produce, you know, I'm looking around the gallery and seeing all this phenomenal work. I am amazed. And, you know, at the time management, the energy that it took to do that, the thought, the production of it, the whole gambit. And I think it's admirable. And that's why I wanted to, you know, talk about this a little bit, because we're always trying to delve into topics that either they're kind of taboo or they just don't get talked about. So thank you for speaking on that.
Well, absolutely. Bring back the show. So in earnest, a lot of my anger on this particular topic, you know, kind of what I, even as far as, you know, what like courts even deem an acceptable like amount of money for rearing a child and so forth. These are the things that were keeping me awake at night. This anger, this like overwhelming feeling of disgust and being cheated and things aren't fair and this isn't right and I'm going to fix it and I have to fix it and what's wrong with me? Why can't I fix it? I'm not smart enough. Why am I not good enough? Blah, 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 blah. And then it was just a loop and it became so detrimental to everything, to everyone, to everything. And that's when I was like, it's like the trains, you know? And then I thought about Sebastian facing the train and that's also right around the time where Andrew comes to me with the show idea. And I'm with it. I'm like, okay, trains. And so the metaphor in the series is, you know, your neuro pathways are like train tracks. The more you think them, the easier they are to go down. And the more the more they carve themselves into your brain tissue. And it is next to impossible to overcome those odds. You know, it'll even be some sort of side thought that you once thought about when you thought about this negative thing. And then suddenly now every time you see a daisy, you think something negative. And then it's prior to that, you thought, oh, I'm going to eat some gummy bears. Now it's gummy bears, daisies. And now you're down the negative thought path again. And it is so hard to break that pattern. And that's why, you know, you have to decide, am I a martyr? Is this what my, is this the definition of what, is this what I want to leave the world with? Is this all that's possible? No, no. So yeah, and that's why I called it Bend the Iron. Cause I loved that. That turn of phrase, first of all, it's very catchy, but second of all, it's yeah. Bend the iron, change your way, change the way you think and change the way you approach, and you can do anything and you can break that and you can break those society norms and you can break the idea of, you know, what Western femininity looks like. And you can break the idea that just because you're attractive doesn't mean you're stupid and you should be taken seriously. And you can do anything you put your mind to. There you go. Yeah. Okay. I'm done.
So I want to pivot a little bit on the same thought though, because we talked a little bit about this and I think Todd, he said, go ahead and introduce it. So let's talk about feminism and as a woman in the art world, what you're up against, the lack of representation in galleries and in museums, the lack of representation as a woman in the art world as a general. Talk about that.
Although I don't know currently in Denver what it looks like, what the, you know, statistics are, I do know nationally as far as represented artists by galleries. So that means they're under contract with a gallery producing art with a curator who is helping them push their work. That is a less than 10% of artists represented by galleries are female. Furthering that, less than 11% of art acquired by museums in the last 10 years, and not we're not talking 1824, we're talking 10 years. So we're talking 2010, 2011. Since then, less than 11% of art is female produced. It gets worse. So basically, that means that female artists, as compared to their male counterparts, are getting paid less than, you know, like you can't even quantify it. So it's the quote, I actually saved it, or the statistic, I actually saved it because I thought it's incredible that nobody figured this out. The market for work by women has doubled in the past decade, but it is still less than the total sales for Picasso alone. One dude, one. We are making up 42%. Females are making up 42% of the art market, or the art that's in the market. And as far as acquisitions, big time acquisitions and big time sales, we are, it's less than the total sales of one man. That's what we're making right now. We can't even keep up with a dead guy. Like, that's insane. And to think that, you know, I mean, there are incredible female artists like Jenny Saville, and these women are changing the narrative, but what does that look like? If you're a curator, are you changing anything? And that's why I stopped using my first name. And do you know, when I stopped using my first name, the percentages of shows I got accepted in went through the roof. And you know who told me that was a female curator. Her name's Perry. She goes by Perry G. Her name's Perry. She said it was the best thing my parents ever did for me is giving me a boy's name. Because I was able to stay competitive in my field. And she's a more conceptual artist. She said, stop using your first name, Amy. Boom. Done. And suddenly I'm getting accepted into this one and this one and this one and this one. And the art's always spoken for itself. I feel that too. But when we talk about, you know, male colleagues, and we don't get the same playing field, you know, it is a hard and a difficult living for anybody, but it is nearly an unclimbable mountain if you're a female. Yeah. So does that answer kind of what you're asking?
Right. Yeah, most definitely.
Okay, cool.
So let's talk a little bit about your work. So what mediums do you work in?
Lately, I've been playing a little more. I love acrylics. They're not great for the environment, but sorry. Acrylic on canvas is my go-to. That's my PB&J, you know. I love it. I own it. I enjoy it. That's my safe zone. That being said, I love watercolors. I love playing with every kind of media. And me and my pencil, man, we've been together my whole life. Yeah. Graphite and I, we're homies. So recently, especially with this train series, I had to find a way to involve grit. There had to be a way to texturally address grit and also paint grit. And how does one approach that? And as much as you can do that with paint, you can't do that with paint. Acrylic paint doesn't work like that. Oils don't work like that. It's just smooth and silky and soft. And even if you're painting something gritty and rigid and hard, you can get those sharp lines, but the physicality of it's just not there. So, I was looking at other artists' work who I appreciated, and Luke and I were actually going back and forth, and we were talking about what other artists were using to create that, like that grit almost. He went shopping and he found liquid charcoal. Change the game. So, liquid charcoal, is unforgiving as hell. You know, it's really difficult to paint over once it's painted, and it's really difficult to work backwards or, you know, cover up a mistake. So you have to be very clear on your vision upon approaching a canvas, but that's part of the beauty of it. So I sketch a little, I add water, I spray a little with, you know, liquid charcoal. I paint with the liquid charcoal. I draw with the charcoal. And that's really cool too, is that once you paint with the liquid charcoal, you can go back in and refine things with drawings. And then you can smear and smudge and also use that acrylic medium, build the texture, then go back with the liquid charcoal. It was a really interesting thing. So my first love, as is and will always be, acrylic on canvas. But I think, you know, we're working past that, and I'm really enjoying playing with new media, especially like watercolor paper. Who knew? It's a great time. You can really play with that stuff. I didn't know. I was just stuck in my little thing. So yeah, that's kind of that's my substrate in media, but I'm never opposed to something new. I do like a nice white starting point though. Yeah, I don't usually address my canvases other ways. I like a white surface to start. Keep it white.
So Wes and I were introduced to your work. I don't know that he realized it or not, but last year at Bit Factory at the No Show.
Okay.
There's a piece called, I believe it's called Watch Me.
Yeah, that's actually right now showing at the Curtis Center for the Arts in Greenwood Village in Colorado. So go check it out. It's there. It's for the, it's showing with the Colorado Women's Caucus for the Arts show. And it's right there, center stage. You walk in, that's the first thing you're seeing. So thanks. So,
Greenwood. Go ahead, Wes.
Oh, I was just going to say, I have a picture of that on my phone. I took a picture. Sorry.
You do?
I do. I love that piece. I really do. I was, I gravitated towards it. I mean, so yeah? It's, yeah. So I'm blown away by it. So talk about it. I mean, it's a little girl with a crown, and you take sure. It away.
Okay. Well, that's my daughter, Della. The gunk on her face is purple shampoo. and she was forced to have it dumped on her head. And I gave her a lot of pictures of powerful self-portraits. And I said, look at what these people are saying with their eyes. Now do that. She was pissed. She was so pissed. She's like, Mom, this is so gross. I hate this. And so we played with a few other things on what, what she would do. And then I gave her this crown. And she was pissed. And she was like, do I put it on? What do I do with it? I'm like, just play with it. Yeah, that's the one. And so she's putting it on her head. And it just looked like, get some. Like, you know, but I think at the moment, I was so, that was that moment that I was, was really trying to branch out. I was really trying to find that, you know, that niche in the market where I'm going to be moving more work, where I can, you know, really, really solidify my position in the art world. And it was just, it was like, yeah, little bit of middle fingers in the air, you know? But so, she's, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so for our listeners who haven't seen it, it's in black and white. What's the medium that used in that?
So that's acrylic on canvas, and
but it's all gray. Gray tones of gray.
It is completely grayscale. God, I should have said that. Yeah. So I do not work in color, unless it's a commission, which, you know, those are kind of, you know, that's what greases the wheels and keeps this train moving. But I'm very strict on that. I find a lot that a viewer has a much more authentic response to a vision or a subject without color. And I'm also not a master of color. And if you know, I said, like, my pencil and I, we go way back, you know, but shape, tone, line, I've got those. Those are my homies, but not color. So I work strictly in a grayscale. That is acrylic on canvas. A lot of those, you know, you don't typically see smooth acrylic. You typically see something a little more, you know, a little faster, a little, you know, because the dry time has to be there. So, but I like that challenge. I like the challenge of a smooth acrylic. And then the other media on that is those are rhinestones that are making the crown. So it's there's actual physical texture on that, and it's very sparkly, but it's girly in its own right because it's sparkly and it's fun, you know. And I love that little part of it. It draws your eye, it grabs you, but it also grabs you because my daughter's eyeballs are absolutely magnetic. I mean, she's such a reluctant model that she's brilliant. You know, she's so mad about it all the time. Like, oh God, again, you know, but that's what makes her absolutely magnetic in these pieces. So she, grayscale, long hair. I extended her hair. Lots of drips, lots of shine, but all in black and white. So as the viewer, you can authentically see this and you're not saying, oh, huh, wonder why it's pink or, you know, whatever. You can see it and you get your goosebumps from the message I'm saying. I always say I'm trying to give you a metaphor with subject, not color, not nothing really else. I'm my metaphors are subject based. So,
well, it's really an interesting piece, and but it as beautiful as it is, it also feels violent to me, and it's because what you have is the color dripping down her face and onto her off her arms and on her chest. It really looks like I beat you for this crown. I don't know what the metaphor you were really going for, but it's a very, like, I'll kick your ass for this crown.
That was kind of what we were going for, you know? And again, like, my partner Luke calls it flow state. I like to call it the tingle, you know, something like that, that you get that tingle, you just know. And sometimes you get it before, and sometimes you get it during, and sometimes you get it after, but you just know that this is like, this is clicking. This is good stuff. I'm making some good stuff here. And I had that upon just its conceptualization, just, you know, like, I'm going to make Della look like she's fighting. I'm going to make her look like Carrie, you know?
Right. And that's, that came to mind too.
Not Carrie, you know?
Yeah. Well, that came to mind though. The Stephen King Carrie character came to mind because it's very much like the look of that, you know? And, I love this piece. And like I said, I took a picture of it. I showed you, it's the only picture I took of that whole, in that whole gallery. It's the,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Remember, do you remember what we did that night?
Yeah.
When we were there.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're getting at, but I mean, I remember what we did.
So the answer is no, I don't remember, Todd.
No, I don't remember what you're getting at, but I remember the whole
thing. What did we do? What did we do?
We went down to reconnaissance. We went down to just check
it out. I know, but specifically in Bit Gallery.
Okay, I don't know what you're getting at, but I'll agree with you once you say it.
So,
of course, that's what I meant.
So, So we went through the entire gallery, I think like three or four different times,
right,
trying to figure out the piece or pieces that really spoke to us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And one of those was your piece.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
we you. Went by, we went through and we looked at every single individual yeah. piece, and then we went back again, and then we had a discussion about the different pieces that we liked, some that we, most of which we agreed upon.
Yeah.
And that piece, I think we decided of that entire show, even though we liked some other pieces, we thought that was the strongest piece out of the entire show.
Thank
I
you.
Mean, there was some great work there. I mean, Dan stuff was there. I mean, and Lee Labier, you know, she was in a piece,
And then Bill had a piece there.
And Bill had a piece.
Which was a really nice piece.
Right. And all of them are phenomenal. But that piece that, you know, Watch Me really, like, I had like a visceral reaction to that. It was very,
thank
I mean,
you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. It's, you know, thank you. And that's good. Those are, it kind of makes reminds me, you know, like just keep doing it. And, yeah. and portraiture is always going to be my first love. I think I'm not a person that like, I go in spaces and places and I do feel a connection to earth and trees and air and all that. But where I really find my grounding, Scott, it is those eyeballs, just as you said, sometimes it's like, God, if I could just, you know, like dip in there and tell that story for something, you know, just, I just want to like figure it out. but yeah, I've always loved portrait. I think my first real memory of really like copying that, of copying portrait and really being completely connected to something is that really classic, painting, that piece of Mary holding, you know, holding the baby. And it's like a Catholic staple. They always put it on, you know, pregnant, need help, you know, whatever. But, but I remember drawing that, you know, as kind of those like old Renaissance portraiture and really just deeply falling in love, because there is something so important in portraiture and human connection. And yeah, it's the same reason we, you know, when Caravaggio started painting chiaroscuro and the heavy darkness meets the bright lights, and as it touches skin, this is what separates us from other creatures. You know, we connect to that so much. And if thank God you guys connected to that, because that's what I'm trying to do, right?
Yeah, but I connected to yours, and it yeah. And Todd, I do remember what you're talking about now, that you kind of brought me back to that time. We did go around like three times, and we said like, what's, you know, we talked about a lot of them, but yeah, that one is, and I see it's for sale for only $20. So it says from $20.
The prints. I don't honestly.
If that sucker was $20, that sucker would be hanging in my living room.
Hey-o, there you go.
No, I do love that piece though. It's amazing. And the figure, you're well, obviously because you love the figure, you're very, very good at it. I mean, painting hands is very difficult from my understanding. You nail it. Well, and I'm looking with a guy with a hammer and a nail. So you nailed it on that one, especially.
Yeah.
Practice makes perfect.
We got some great, we had great response to that series. Bill represented me for that series. That was a few years ago. And without diving too much into like my personal stuff, it was maybe about a person who found their spouse having an affair and who then killed said spouse and mistress and buried them under their chicken coop. I don't know. These are just thoughts. I'm just saying them. But so what it was is there's all these fun, like weird still lifes of like shattering skulls and, you know, or just like hammers and nails. But every piece in that series, the name of it told part of the story. So upon seeing the whole series, you didn't know what it was saying. You know, you had these like images of hands, you know, hammering a nail, and then then hands holding a hammer over a skull, and then hands smashing skull, and you know, and upon looking at that, you're like, oh, it's an interesting still life. But then you see the progression of the names of the pieces, which was, that was so cathartic for me. And the fact that Bill knew what I was working through, and he knew what was happening in my life, and he didn't have a single problem with me writing this whole like story of, you know, and having it conclude. That was like a, I think it was 26 drawings on toned paper in black and white colored pencil. And it was, the hands are, I love those hands. And I love telling a story that you don't know you're reading, hearing, learning. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But yeah, that was a fun one. So thanks for remembering that. That was a really fun one. My favorite response to it was at a First Friday, I was standing, and this is like, I'm a creeper like this. And I usually stand with my giant Nalgene in the corner and just listen to the responses. Usually it's spiked with something stronger. And the one that was my favorite of all time was a man after walking through the whole thing, and he goes, "Who are you, Amy? And what is happening to you?" And I said, "I'm right here." But it was really funny because it was so dark. And thanks. Yeah, sorry. That was a rabbit hole tangent. But
so I want to ask you about artist statements. When you're hanging this, let's go back to that gallery showing with, when you were doing that show and you're creating this artist statement, is it basically kind of telling the story what the audience is seeing?
Yeah. Well, the way I usually go about an artist statement is I say, look at the work, let it tell your story, like let it inform you and let it get you to where you want to be, and then see where I went with it. You know, so I like developing a unique artist statement for each series, each piece. And, or, you know, pieces. For that one, I called it fiction. And I just talked about, you know, how creation is cathartic. And even where I began with that was just, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. I am out here. I am floating. Life is hard right now. Where do I even begin? And it just began with just a still life, just a still life. And so you start with that, and then suddenly something, you know, then the tingle, then the flow, whatever, then it happens and it clicks. And, but artist statements can be very limiting too. So you have to, I really think they're important for an artist, not only to like kind of legitimize and ground what they're doing and saying, but I think it's also, you know, it gives the viewer, if you couldn't get something out of it, maybe an answer to the, huh? Yeah. And those are tricky to craft. Like some, you know, sometimes you go about it and you're like, oh good God, where do I even begin? That's my 3-year-old daughter.
Cause you could give away too much, right? Where you, exactly. Where you start limiting, yes, what the viewer sees.
Yes. Yes. So in those, I try to stick to the kind of answer the basic questions, who, what, why, where, when, and how. You talk about what inspired you without giving away like too much, what you learned, what you got out of it, and, you know, how you did it, substrate, media, time. And, you know, we could all be Clifford Still and just, you know, I call it like artist statement is like verbal masturbation for artists. It's like, you know, like, oh my God, I'm so good. Just look at all my work. Oh my God, I'm so good. But you can masturbate as long and as hard as you want, or you can just keep it short and sweet and kind of just try to answer like the most basic questions. But it's also, you know, that like separates, I hate this turn of phrase, but I'm going to use it, like the men from the boys. A person with a coherent artist statement knows their shit, you know, and somebody who isn't writing artist statements or who can't do that, they're like, well, who are you? But it also gives you a verbal kind of, gives you like the verbal cues to be able to speak coherently about your art when it comes to these shows, because that's the only way you're moving work. And that's the only way, you know, you're penetrating your market, and you're, you know, every once in a while you have to masturbate, but, mm-hmm. you know, you try to do it in an authentic way. So.
Right. Right. I like the term. Sometimes you just have to masturbate.
Sometimes you do.
So kind of to twist this a little bit, and Todd's like crawling under his table now. twist this, when you were talking about, you know, how the artist describes their artwork, it also reminds me of like when you go to an art museum and they're talking about, or you listen to some art historians, some art critics talking about a piece of work, and they're getting all these really weird things out of it. And you're like, what the hell do they even see here? You know, yeah. It's kind of interesting. I kind of enjoy it, but at the same time, I'm like, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Like, well, in this, you know, his use of color here really represents, and I'm sure there's some well-educated thought that went into that, but oh my God, sometimes they pull some weird stuff out, but.
Sure. Yeah. It's, and that's where it becomes, I forget who says this, and it's a very famous quote, like, find the art in yourself or yourself in the art, you know? I mean, there have to be in the world, the Clifford Stills with, like, you know, the 18 page artist statements. There has to be that guy, because you have to calibrate where you want to lie on that spectrum. I don't want to be that guy. Right. You know, tooting your own horn is only so cool.
Right.
But again, yeah, it does. It help. And it helps, I think, yeah, into antiquity, you would hope that when people look back on what you were trying to say, that they get it too. Mm-hmm. Your message isn't lost. So Hopefully.
I wouldn't have read your artist statement last night if you hadn't brought me over and had me read it.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, good.
And the reason being is that I hate artist statements.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of good ones, but there's a ton of bad ones. You know, it's like you read through it and you're like, that was bullshit. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I was totally enjoying the show until I actually had to read the writing of the artists. And I don't know what they thought they had to say, but I'm like, God damn, you know, I could have done without that. And so, you know, and I didn't, you know, I didn't have any, I don't know. I was probably going to choose not to read it only because I was enjoying the show so much. And like I said, I've had experiences where I read it and I'm like, oh God, you know, I was really enjoying this. And then I read this artist statement. So
But
yours is very well written and very good.
Thank you.
I hate writing artist statements myself.
Okay.
Because I do think they're kind of, you know, as the whole art world gasps, I just think they're, I don't know. The work should speak for itself, but I get why people want you to have a statement of what the thought behind it.
Like we want to know, I want to know, you know, especially the Caravaggios of the world, you know, like just to bring in that again, what were you doing here, bro? Like, what? Somebody's head's cut off. How did you know what that looked like? You know, sometimes you want a few questions answered.
Well, I'd rather have a dialogue with the artist as opposed to just reading an artist statement. You know, a lot of times you go to a show and sometimes the artist isn't there. Sometimes they're not able to be there, but I'd much rather interact with the artists. And so I want you to speak to that, because we've talked about this before. How important is that connection between the artist and the collector, or the artist and the potential art buyer, do you think?
Oh, God. Well, that's 90% of the battle too, is that you want your audience to be respectful to your vision. You want a buyer to be someone that wants to see this. I've also had the problem of you don't want to be beholden to your buyer either, which I've had that weird kind of thing happen before. You know, like somebody assumes because they purchase your work that you're somehow like they're due. And I've heard that from other artists, the dance monkey thing. I had a colleague of mine tell me about a time where a couple bought a ton of his work, decorated their dining room with it, and then at a dinner party and invited him. And they were just like, go monkey, talk about work, you know, and how offended he was by that. And there's some of that. You need to do some of that. Like you said, you want to have a dialogue, but you know, it's kind of a threefold thing. You want a buyer to look at you with A, the respect you deserve, B, the, you know, they want to support the integrity of the work. You know, they don't want like dance monkey happening. And I hope to connect with everybody, even if it's somebody who's buying print. I want to connect with that viewer. I think it was really interesting. There's a woman that came to that show and she couldn't afford, you know, with the big stuff. She couldn't afford the big stuff, but she bought 4 or 5 prints and just, she couldn't get enough. Like she just couldn't get enough of how to deep dive. And then I found out later that her husband had just passed. And for her, the tracks was her sorrow. And she's just moving past this. You know, she lost her husband during COVID and she can't have his funeral and she can't have, like, he died of cancer, so it wasn't quite the same, but she's dealing with so much anger and so much trauma and so much, and that's what you want. That's the viewer I want. Had I known her story, I would, you know, I'd do this for free if I could. If I could afford it, God, I'd just give it away. Because it's all, that's like all I ever have wanted to do. It helped tell her story. It helped got her to a place where she felt something sparked her. And my friend that was her connection, you know, she came with a friend, told me later, you know, she talked about this for hours. I couldn't get her to shut up about it, you know? So she said, look at this and look at this part of this piece over here that I have and look at this and look at this. And, you know, God, it's like, just even bringing it up now, it's still giving me goosebumps. Cause it's like, that's what you want. And God, right. I would hope that every buyer is like that. Sometimes they're not. I've also struggled with the situation where buyers, you know, now I bought something and I have your phone number now. So now I get to text you whenever I want to, you know, and that's like, that's also that weird door you open when you do this as a woman and, you know, in a vulnerable, you're more susceptible for those kinds of connections too, I think. But because your soul's out there, you know, you're like, hey world, this is me inside, this is me outside, this is all of it. And then some people can take advantage of that too. So that kind of sucks. But like that woman I was just speaking of, then if that was the only thing I ever got out of anything, that would still be worth it.
So right. That's the highest compliment you could be paid, that she was felt so strongly that she just couldn't get enough of what you had just done. That experience was helping her. It's helping her heal is what it is.
Right. Right.
You know, she's processing, right. You know, and it's helping her do that. And that's, yeah, it doesn't get any better than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Exactly. And that anger can be really, really weird, especially with neural pathways. That shit carves a big gash really fast, you know? And it's, anger is a secondary emotion too. So where her pain and anger was kind of toward the world that she wasn't able to celebrate her husband. She felt so alone in his passing, so alone and like, you know, middle fingers in the air type of thing. But that's so good. Cause when you think of that, you know, you think bend the iron, you think, oh, I'm not alone in this. That like negative thought pattern, anger thought pattern is so easy, but it's not real. It's not real. It's just, it's up to me to figure out how to, you know, how to bend the iron. And it's that hard. You know, it takes so much training in your brain. It's like, you know, it's easier to jog a marathon than it is to retrain your brain. And sometimes you're working with like lifetimes worth of weird stuff that you have to retrain out of you, but it's possible. And if I can do that for just one person, that like it feels, suddenly something feels more possible because somebody else did it, then Absolutely. That's why I'm here.
You mentioned representation through Bitfactory. Do you have other gallery representation currently?
So yes and no. So I'm represented by Electric Cherry, and that's in Arvada, but Allison also sells wares, and you know, she's kind of, she calls herself a boutique. So she works with a lot of local artists though, which is fabulous. And she sells stickers and like this and that, and the, you know, she kind of, and then records, and the place is really dope. If you haven't ever seen it or checked it out, it's really cool. She moves a lot of my stuff actually though, because you know, not everybody's going into a gallery and they don't necessarily think like, hey, I can afford this work. And she had a series of mine that I painted years ago for no show, for Bill, and or for Bill's show. Pardon. And actually, funny enough, one of the models that for the train series, she had modeled for that series. And Allison moved them lickety split. She had started calling her Electric Cherry girls and having people pose in front of these paintings, and bam, out the door. You know, so she's great. And our gallery's in Boulder, and Rob at our gallery, he doesn't currently represent me, but he has moved quite a bit of my work, and he does several calls for entry. And so we've done those together. So while I can't quite say he's a full-time representation, he also does the kind of representation. He's kind of has like a membership type of thing. So if and when I'm ready to make that kind of commitment, I can do that too. He's fabulous. And then obviously I said that right now in the Curtis Center for the Arts is housing my piece, and the O'Hanlon Center for the Arts, which is in California, it's close to San Francisco, they have another one of my pieces. Also the CASP, Charles Adams Studio Project, they have a piece of mine in Lubbock, Texas. So they're currently representing me. The Dab Art Company in Los Angeles, I think this is the last one, I promise. They have rights to one of my pieces to publish. One of the pieces last night that you saw was Della again. It was my oldest daughter. She was in a dress and just crumpled with the train next to her and just a white void. Big piece. It's 4 foot by 5 foot. And Dab picked that up for their book, Art in the Time of Corona. And they really wanted to focus on the art that could reflect the mental toll that this virus and these expectations are taking on children. Yeah, that should be a really, really cool completed project, let's say. But
yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you.
You're on social media?
I am. I have an Instagram, A Lummis Art, and a Facebook page is just Amy Lummis, and that's it. I can't hang with Twitter. It's just a lot. But and then I also obviously have my website, amyleelummis.com.
Have you sold any pieces via social media?
I have. I sold one called Rock, Paper, Scissors. And not exactly social media. So yes, I have sold stuff off of Instagram. And I really love that when a client will come to me personally, especially if it's something I've been sitting on a while, because I'm so excited to negotiate. You know, I'm never too proud. Let's just say that, you know. I would so much rather move the work than have to paint over it and have to reuse the material. Like I'd much prefer to move the work. And I've also moved work with that series, that fiction series. There was a piece like this, and it was called Let's Play Rock, Paper, Scissors. I win, you die, you lose, you die. But it was featured on CNN, CNN style. And, it's still on there. It was an article about two Japanese, art collectors playing rock, paper, scissors over Renoir. And so I was featured for that. So I sold from that too. So it's not exactly social, but it's, sort of.
Yeah. talk about your work. What is the price point where it starts and what does it go up to?
Well, that's an interesting thing. So I have, this is a dialogue I have often with my colleagues. They like to tell me I'm underpricing my work. I like to say that I want everybody to have a peace of mind. So I try not to go above 3,500. I think that that's, for me, I'd rather have 20 collectors with a work, a piece of my, an original piece of art in that price point than one collector with that's something that was $12,000. You know, I don't want to price myself out. I like the sweet spot, and the sweet spot in this market is about 300 to 500 for your non-collecting buyer. So that's if that's like somebody who would walk by and go, oh my gosh, I love that art. I can't stop thinking about that art. That 300 to 500 mark, they like that. You know, somebody, a passerby feels like, okay, I can save for that. I can find a way to buy that. I get scolded often for this too, because that will only make my work so, you know, keep me at one level. But I like to argue too that I want, yeah, art must be accessible. We must make this accessible. Again, we're back to it. Somebody has to pave this path. Somebody has to make this, like, this thing, you know, you have to make yourself open to your fellow man, right? Or woman or whomever. So I try to find my sweet spot. So for instance, in this last show, most of my pieces were around $300. And then, you know, the large scale canvases, especially if it's had critical praise or review, or if it's been picked up by big name galleries, I'm definitely going to move that at a higher price point. So we're looking like 3,500 ish. So, and then the rest in the middle.
Beyond what you just talked about, as far as the galleries that have pieces of yours right now, did you have any shows canceled this year because of the pandemic? Outside of Bend the Iron earlier in the year.
Right. Well, yes and no. So I had shows that turned into online shows. So that was something, because you don't move work on an online show at all. That's not real. As much as they're great for developing your resume, because you get the same kind of clout on your resume that you would if it was in an in-person show, but they're not moving work at all. There was one at the Cape Cod Center for the Arts. They had to move their show online, and but that was actually okay, because I wasn't too opposed to not having to ship that to Cape Cod. Bend the Iron was the main one that was, you know, postponed. And working with Bill last, you know, he's had to completely rework everything his entire year. So we're slated currently to have a show on, and I'll be doing a solo show, which is very unique for Bill. He doesn't do solo shows with other artists, I think, except for himself and then one other artist once. So I will be second ever. I am doing a solo show with Bill, but that was kind of in a way to make up for this really weird year that we usually do at least two shows a year together. And we didn't do one together this year, which, outside of no show, which is, you know, two shows a year, no show, and then one more. So not directly canceled, but had to kind of be rescheduled, reworked, reconfigured.
Outside of the gallery representation and your website, what other things do you do to try to market your work?
You know, I do a lot of commissions, so I do market those, and I do that via social media, but that's kind of, again, that's like what I said, like it's greasing the wheels. So, and I love that. I really do. So around Mother's Day, lots of kid portraits. And around Christmas, lots of pet portraits. And actually, I love that. I love that. And again, that's a way that like a small sketch of mine, you know, I know where the value lies and everything, but like I love it when a client comes to me and says, okay, it's my husband's birthday. I have $200, what you got, you know? And then we come up with a project together that feels like that's the right price point for me. And that feels authentic for them, that they get not only a piece of original art, but they don't have to go through Etsy or something like that, where they're paying fees. That being said, I still do have a Redbubble page. This year is the first year I'm even really considering Etsy or something along those lines, because commissions are terrific. It's just the problem with a lot of those websites, Redbubble, like even Redbubble, you sell something for $25, you see as the artist, $4.50 of that. Unless you are doing mass sales on Redbubble, which some artists are, this is their platform, this is how they do it, you're really not seeing a lot of return on investment for your time. I would like to further like a Patreon page and those kinds of things, because that's when, you know, your friends and family, they can sign up for being your patron for $1 a month. They're your patron. Nobody notices that dollar coming out. But if I'm getting 300 of those people to sign up and support me, you just paid my groceries for the week, you know? And so that's kind of a cool thing too, that they have signed up. The setup, and Patreon was initially created for the arts, you know, so I should be doing stuff like that. Maybe I need to get that started, but I'm currently how I market myself is, yeah, mostly Instagram, Facebook, word of mouth. Obviously I do some direct mail advertising when I have shows. I have a mailing list. I like to send out postcards. I also do like henna. So I have on the weekends a lot. I have clients like I've done that. I started that when I was 13 years old, and I've been doing it for, this was my 21 years. And so it's where it started, as like a fun little thing for, like, you know, I'd go to like local festivals and, you know, some people babysat. I did henna tattoos. I still do that on the side sometimes. And that's a great way to promote myself too. Often that's how I find my clients. It'll be, hey, we heard about you through so-and-so and so-and-so. You did a portrait for them. They mentioned you also did, you know, a henna tattoo for their kid. And we would really like this, or we would really like that, or how would you feel about this? Or, you know, and then they come to the next three gallery shows and then become close friends. And you know, and then you draw something for grandma, and you draw something for dad, and then you draw something for cousin, and then their sisters. And so word of mouth marketing is my main jam. And that, I like that too. It makes it very personal.
You're good at it.
Thank you.
So I want to circle back around to this newest body of work, Bend the Iron. How did that, I want you to really kind of get into the, you kind of talked about it briefly at the beginning of the podcast, but I'd like you to kind of delve into that as far as how that came about, that whole concept.
Right. Well, trauma. I think I went through a lot, and we discussed the series Fiction. But that wasn't the end all and be all of that. And that whole litigation process, the everything that drug on for a long time. And what that kind of constant repetitive remembering of every naive, ignorant decision you made and beating yourself up for that. That was the synthesis of the work. You know, it came a little from Andrew. It came a little from seeing my son, but mostly it came from this battle I was losing. And even now, like, I think the end of the series, I named that piece Liberated or Conquered, because did I change who I am in order to alleviate the stress of that really repetitive negative thought cycle, or did I change it, or did it change me? You know, where do you go with it? So that's how that was created. And the way I like to work into a series is I have the concept, I know where I want to go, but I haven't fully gotten into it. So when I knew I wanted to use train as a metaphor, I wanted to learn about trains is this a proper metaphor? Does this work? And again, like men love trains, women love trains, everybody loves trains, they're kind of cool. So I started doing still lifes of trains. I started doing still lifes of train toys. I started doing still lifes of, especially I loved the look of retired locomotives, like the old overgrown locomotives in fields and that kind of thing. And this juxtaposition of hard iron with soft earth and just devoid of any humanity anymore. You know, these things, we created them and they were everything for a while, you know, trains and all of this. And, you know, they were the future and then poop, well, never mind. You know, we're such fickle creatures. And then they're just left and they don't go anywhere. They're these giant iron beasts. And so I learned a lot about trains, you know, I learned about like these things have, you know, so much horsepower. I forget. It's the equivalent of something like 120 semi trucks as far as horsepower is concerned. And some of these diesel engines, and you're facing that with the weight of, you know, 80 elephants. That's what we did. We made that. Humans made that. And so I researched trains. I drew trains. I drew toy trains. I bought toy trains. I went to train museums. I went to train stores. I got to know the weirdos that collect trains. I went to train websites. I went, oh my God. Like I got from one guy and I used it in my artist statement. I think I may have even used the metaphor later. Oh, I read children's books on trains. Oh my God. I have every children's book on trains because sometimes those authors, they're for the mind of a child. So they say and do things that are so much different than you would normally think. But like twin steel ribbons. How cool is that? Like that's so, oh. And when you do, you look at trains and they're going all the way out and it is. They're twin steel ribbons wrapping the earth. Isn't that fabulous?
That is fabulous.
Yeah. So, you know, I really dove deep. And then when I connected to it, really connected to it, and I'd wake up, and this is again, I was very much solo. And you wake up in the middle of the night and you only have like, at this point I was, my kids, Sebastian wasn't in kindergarten yet. Penny wasn't in daycare. So my kids are with me full time during the day. And then I'm tucking them in and I'm working at night and I'm going to bed and I'm sleeping 4 or 5 hours. And so every single second of sleep is so precious. And then if you're getting woken up in the middle of the night by these like trauma dreams and you wake up and you're, and once I was able to equate that with this locomotive boom through my brain, you know, literally piercing my sleep. And it's not just metaphor, you know, this actually happens to people that a train will ride by and wakes them up in the middle of the night, you know, it made sense. And then it started giving me a narrative to, oh, that's just another train waking me up, you know, like shut it down. And the synthesis of that work was a deep dive, but I think at the end of it, I learned a lot about neuroscience. I love it. And I always like to equate when I'm doing these series on how that equates to brain function, and being aware of your brain as a muscle, it's very important, I think, as a human, you know, it's just part of the inner workings, learning how to utilize that metaphor for benefit. And learning how to draw something that's kind of hard for somebody that draws people all the time, very soft, sensual people with squishy forms, drawing like hard steel, iron things, you know, really stiff strokes. I talked about that a little in my artist statement. That was a kind of a hard thing. You know, you stop. I really did. I had to stop curving lines. I had to start drawing like a robot, you know, that was a difficult thing, but learned a lot about how to work, learned a lot about process, you know. It was very gratifying.
It seems like, and at least with this particular series or this theme, it almost possesses you. Like you're so engrossed and learning about everything you can about the subject that it just kind of overtakes you.
Absolutely.
And then you start to channel stuff, right?
Yes, exactly. So I said this last night, I don't really remember, but I may or may not have said this last night. I love this metaphor, and one of my favorite musicians says it. It's David Gray, and he also loves trains, by the way. He describes, and he did this in an interview, and he says, I have to sometimes just lift the lid off of my mind and stop filtering what goes in so I can just let it through. And I loved that. You really do have to just dive so deeply. But this is also a struggle of mine as a human being, because as I said, when I was 2 years old, I told the world I was going to be an artist, and I never let it go. I get something between my teeth and I grind it to a pulp. I mean, I call it dog with the bone syndrome. You know, you just, I really, when I get into something, I get into it. And it's sort of like I have blinders on. And again, there's that turn of phrase, where does your service lie right now? You know, like whose base needs are being met right now? Are yours? Have you eaten in the last 24 hours? You know, that kind of thing. That happens. But I think that strength of will and that kind of tunnel vision focus and that kind of, I mean, it's almost myopathy, you know, you just dive so deeply, but it's very beneficial for me as an artist because I'm encompassed and then I'm done. And then I'm done. And I don't have to think about it ever again because it's in me and then it's out of me and it's done. And I feel much better about it.
So it's been the iron over for you?
Yes. At the time I thought I might revisit it, and because I was looking at my prep sketches and I still had about three or four other very solid ideas. I loved the idea of doing like a self-portrait with a train kind of emerging from my mouth. I thought that was a cool one. Also one with the mouth and like tracks kind of like spew. I was like, oh man, I had some really surrealistic visions. Ears, you know, tunnel. I kind of like that one because, you know, you're in the middle of the night. All of that being said, when Corona hit, my oldest had to be homeschooled and work on that came to a grinding halt, but that was okay. Because again, where did my service lie? You know, at that point it needed to lie with these babies who, you know, we're struggling with. Suddenly we don't get to see our friends, and suddenly we don't get to see grandma and grandpa, and suddenly we don't get to, you know, and, God, I remember. So this was when Luke and I were dating, and just even him, we couldn't see him, but him putting groceries on our doorstep was the most joy they had felt in weeks. You know, that was a monster. And God willing, we're not in that boat again. But yeah, so that's where it had to end. And I'm so glad it's ended. I needed it. I needed to not only show the work, I needed to just be done. The catharsis happened. It's over. I'm ready to play with some joy, and I've got a new series started, and it's so silly and it's so joyful, and I'm having a great time with it. So
in addition to producing this stunning art, you also write, you journal, and you write poetry. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about that.
Oh, I love writing poetry. Well, with most of my work, I journal a lot, and as a massive bibliophile, I often, as I paint, I listen to books. I read a lot. I read myself to sleep at night. I have to do it. I have to read always. I have to be listening to a book. I have to be reading a book. But words are important to me. Communication is important to me. So especially in those moments when I'm never quite bereft of inspiration, but in the moments when things feel quite heavy, and for that point they did, especially, you know, those like, sleep is so precious, why can't I get back there? Writing was and will forever be the way that I get through it. And I love Hemingway, and I love his kind of stream of consciousness style. So the way that I write is often, I write it like I want it to be said. And I write a lot in metaphor, and I write a lot in visuals. And I try to write, like for this, I remember writing to attempt to feel like you were on a train, like chicka, 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 chicka. So it was really fun too, to kind of play with like rhythms and feelings, and they're almost like musical performative quality of poetry. And a lot of it's for me, you know, a lot of it's like, I think I must have done like 15 poems for this particular series, if you could call them that. They're just kind of like scribbles. But then the two that I did have displayed were, I think, kind of the pinnacle of the writing, and also very, I felt really powerful pieces. Andrew and I had planned on me performing those in front of everybody, because it was, he had looked at a lot of them and he's like, this is a knockout thing. And so my actress of a mother and I were, you know, I was practicing in front of her and she was giving me tips, and it was this whole thing. It was really cool to connect with her in a different way too. And yeah, so I write, and I think, again, that helps me inform my artist statement. That helps me inform my ability to communicate about my art. And it also helps me just spew out all the evil crap that comes out of my brain sometimes. All the angry stuff, all the feeling sorry for yourself stuff. It's important to have it's important to have as many creative outlets as possible, because otherwise I'd go crazy.
So what's your process as somebody who journals? Do you write every day?
No. It often is deeply connected to a series, because like I said, I deep dive into these visuals often. I like being able to tell a story too. You know, I think again, yeah, I was raised by actors there. I like telling stories. So no, I don't do it every day, but often writing will give me a metaphor. I'll stumble upon something that suddenly gives me a visual insight, or the opposite, where I'll have something visual and I need to write it out in order to be able to figure it out. One, for instance, one of the poems I had displayed, this is a fun fact, but time as we know it did not exist before trains. Clocks were not around much. They weren't used much. And if they were, they were never the same as somebody's in, you know, Topeka, and somebody's in Denver, and somebody's in, you know, in Houston or whatever. So we had to adopt this. We had to adopt this like world clock. We had to adopt time. We had to be on time. Time and trains are inexorably connected. And for me, I couldn't quite capture that in a painting, but I felt like I did with one of my poems, and that's mind blowing, right? Until we started, you know, putting these twin steel ribbons around the world, we didn't have time. What? You know, so what does that look like? Trains and time. And I love the metaphor of the trains, thought and control. You know, that's a lot of the theme that you see kind of pervasive throughout the series. So in that particular piece, it was control and trains and time and squeezing it. And, you know, I love that idea. I'm also late to like I have to tell myself everything starts an hour before I'm supposed to be there, because I'm like just perpetually so bad at keeping time. So it's a battle of mine as well. I connected it on that level too.
Time has been beat into me because I was in the military.
Sure.
So being prompt is important to me.
Yeah. Well, it is to me too. You know, I feel like it's a respect piece. So you have to like,
right.
You have to, and when you're the dog with the bone, you know, and you can't, you're just so into the train, you know, you got to be able to like, and to have a way to get out of that. I'm much better about it now. But you know, it's when I was diving into these, I was like, wow, you know, like the trains control time. It's an amazing idea. So
yeah. One other thing before, because you're an avid reader, give us two books that you think everybody should read.
I'm not a huge memoir person, but I recently read Untamed by Glennon Doyle. Damn that woman. She nailed it. She nailed it. So I definitely recommend that. And all the time, always, I'm going to recommend Terry Mancourse, the Spellmonger series. Every single person I've recommended this series to has deep dived. I mean, it is, I like anybody that I've recommended it to that has actually read it, they're on book 12. They're on book 50. You know, he is amazing. He's Tolkien-esque in his craft. And he gets a little detailed, but not unlike Tolkien. You know, he kind of sometimes he gets really into the nuance. And like, I don't know if I need to know this as the reader. Oh, the way he describes battle, the way he describes love. He's silly. He's fun. He's thrilling. He's a phenomenal writer. And I'll always say Hemingway, and I'll always say Kate Chopin. I should change the game. Jane Austen, another one. I belong to a Jane Austen book club. That's a real life thing. I'm that kind of nerd. But yeah, every woman should read Kate Chopin. That's just, that should be a requirement. The Awakening, but yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more before we sign off about Bend the Iron. And for our listeners, if you go to Amy's website, she mentioned it earlier, amyleelumus.com. It's AmyLeelumus.com. Go to the Bend the Iron section. Before we talk about a piece or pieces, I want to know if you'll indulge me. Will you be willing to recite one of the poems that you wrote for this show?
Hell yeah, Todd. You, me, performing? What? That would be lovely. That would be an honor. Yes, please. Sure. I would love to do that. Thank you. Let me find it first. Okay, there were two that I had. I think this one's a better performer, so I will do this one. This one is titled My Wheels Push Only Forward on This Track. Okay. I have this gray day in a gray Colorado spring. I am alone, yet I am loud in a gray place with gray dirt and gray rocks next to black tracks. And I breathe the gray air and I spare no time. My wheels push only forward on this track. I've built billows of black smoke in my wake, thick and furtive, hideous. None may stop me. I repudiate feeling. I need not coarse sensations. Sensations lead to introspection. Introspection leads to bitterness. Bitterness leads to regretting. And I will not regret my use of time. My wheels push only forward on this track. Don't talk of violent feeling. I can't bear the informality. I'm enormous. I'm hard. I am unnerving. And time is what is mine. The treasure of treasures. Precious time. I determine speed. I determine strength. I determine power. Control may be an illusion, but it is my illusion to control. And my wheels push only forward on this track. I have my steel. I have my iron. I have my gray air. I have my black tracks. I have my bitterness. I have my illusion. And I have my time. And time is mine. My wheels push only forward on this track. Even if I could change my trajectory, my arrival, my plan, my future, I wouldn't. I would keep time. I would hoard time. I would worship time. I move my wheels forward. Time knows no other way. Time thickly uncompromising. Time ignores change. And I too refuse change, ignore change, because time is mine. And my wheels push only forward on this track. Sorry. Okay, I'm done.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
I love it.
Thanks. Thanks for indulging me too. I worked kind of hard on figuring out how to perform that well, and I didn't get to do it. So thanks.
You did a good job tonight.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And I used to watch Deaf Poetry all the time back in the early 2000s. that was a great series. And just to hear spoken word, because poetry is meant to be spoken. It's meant to be heard, not just meant to be read.
Right.
And I love it. And you did a phenomenal job. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Some of the pieces that I really enjoyed, I loved all of them, but what resonated with me, and we kind of talked about this when we first connected, is a lot of more of the kind of illustrative kind of, I mean, it's stuff that harkens back to my childhood. And I think I kind of talked with you about that before. Hmm. There's these illustrations that are just wonderful and they're romantic, and it takes me back to my childhood. You know, I feel like I'm, when I look at some of these pieces, I feel like I'm looking, like I said, at a page and a book that I'm reading, you know, and it just transports me back. Let's talk about a couple pieces that you just, you love from the series that you really enjoyed working on and that you just, you like.
Sure. Absolutely. It's a love hate relationship. I loved the, what I call Strangle Train. I posed for that one myself, and it had a lot to do with the closing a book on experiences of mine. And it felt so weird and so alien, like giraffe like and awkward. And, but at the same time, oddly enough, I thought that was a tricky one to know to want to show, because it was really personal. I got asked for prints for that one so much more than I got asked for any of the other prints. And I thought, okay, you know, because maybe not everybody has that same experience, but it doesn't change that we all sometimes feel that, you know. That being said, so that was an important and cathartic piece to make. Is it my favorite? No, but it was my favorite to be finished. I was avoiding exploring for a long time. So I was really happy when I saw the product, and it was a solid piece. And I felt like, yeah, okay. I explored it and I'm done.
And describe that for our listeners.
Okay. So it is a piece, it's a self-portrait. It's a portrait of me, and in lieu of my neck, or maybe as my neck, I become part of the train, and the stack of the train where the smoke comes out, the main funnel where the smoke is expelled, is my neck. And there are two male hands surrounding that chute or my neck and squeezing. So it's a little violent, but and clearly in the piece, I'm not in pain. It's not a violent piece, but it was something I needed to explore, and I'm glad it's done. That one. And I think also the one, oh God, they were all great. I really, really enjoyed exploring this series. I mean, it's funny you ask that, because I can think of things that I really loved painting, you know, like those moments when you're just in your pure ecstatic state. It's like the most me I feel is when I'm creating these things. There's one that not everybody loved this one, but it was just my friend posed for it, and she's like crouched in kind of the fetal position. She's nude and she's in front of this gigantic train. And that one was really fun because I hadn't explored trains from that era yet. So that one was fun for that reason.
Is that the Facing the Train?
Yes. Yes. That's called Facing the Train. And what was my favorite? You know, I can tell you, like, sometimes my least favorite, but my favorite, my friend Rachel, and also she's Luke's sister. She's just this really innately peaceful human. And so I really wanted to talk about grace. That was also one of the themes that I played with, and I really enjoyed drawing her, and I really hated how it turned out. And no matter how much I tried to fix it, it didn't work. And so as far as like enjoyability of completing it, it was so much fun and I was flowing with it. And then her train that was behind her in this moment of just like the wind's blowing and she's emanating this pure grace through these magnetic eyeballs of hers. There's this very phallic looking engine that's like emerging behind her. And I took it from a photograph I'd taken. The train itself was real. It was a real thing, but I didn't paint it right. I'm not pleased with the final product. I really wish I had. I even put it not for sale because I'm maybe I could fix it someday. You know, I don't know. But I think my other favorite is probably the one of Della in the large white void where she's just laying in there. There's the two toy trains, because I think as far as stark metaphor is concerned, that one speaks volumes. So I'm really happy that it's going to be published and it'll be in,
And that's alone with my train, right?
Yes. Yes.
That is a really beautiful piece.
Yeah.
So while I was walking around last night, I kind of started jotting down words of like things that I was feeling from looking at all the different pieces. And so I wrote down serious, sensual, whimsical, and power. Because cool. I felt like all the women that were depicted, which in some way, shape, or form are you.
Yeah.
Right?
Right,
And channeling yourself through your models through other women.
Right.
But it was very empowering, I felt, these pieces.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yes, absolutely. It was important to me at the end of this to really focus on you are your conductor, you know, that these neural pathways that sometimes we force ourselves into, you are under your own control. You control your time. You control your brain. You control so much. And especially when I look around and I think of power in society and what I'm willing to accept is reality and what I'm not. I want those pieces to emanate power. I don't ever want somebody to look at something and feel discomforted. I want them to feel empowered. So thank you. Yes. And I love that like whimsical is also part of sensual. You know, it's just, thank you. Those are great. Those are fantastic adjectives. It's half the battle, right? You want it to be evocative, but straightforward enough for everybody, palatable, but challenging. Yeah, that's the attempt is there. I'm glad it resonates.
So you had the pop-up show, the first time it's been shown as a body of work. Where does it go now? You alluded to the fact last night in conversation that you had a conversation with people in South Dakota early on in doing this project. And we have a lot of listeners in South Dakota. Wes is in South Dakota.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about that. And is that still something that might still happen?
Absolutely. So I went to Rapid City and spoke to the curator of the doll. They are accepting proposals. So she just wanted kind of a completed series and a completed proposal, which she'll get. The difficulty with shopping to any kind of museums and curators is that until I was completed with my, not only our vision, but in, you know, Andrew, we had a verbal agreement and I really wanted to make sure I was finished there before I could move forward. But I really loved the idea of, I felt like the Dakotas, especially, you know, trains and you know, westward expansion, that all those metaphors really are great for those areas of the United States. And especially a place like the Doll that gets some interesting work and is willing to jump into something a little more avant-garde, but maybe that audience wouldn't be exposed to that fine art and without a challenge, you know, it's almost like that. Here's the trains. Those are yummy, palatable, easy. Here's a little bit of some more interesting, more contemporary ideas. And now here's the big contemporary ideas. And that's exactly what the audience I want to, you know, I want to find. Cause smaller museums like the Doll are exactly where I want to be. I want to be able to connect with an audience who would never have found my work otherwise. And maybe there's, you know, the kid or the, you know, the mom or whomever is being told in like a smaller community that, hey, well, it might be hard to be a full-time artist. And they see this work and they see this person and they go, no, not really. I can do it too. Yeah. So that would be incredible. But now that I'm saying it, I better toot that horn. Make sure signs feel delivered and off to South Dakota.
Put it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually, so upon, before we broke down last night, kind of the ritual I have is I sit down with whomever's like the stragglers and say, okay, what are we doing next? You know, like, where does this work go now? And often with pop-up shows, I have the great honor of I've never moved less than 50% of what I'm showing at a show, at a pop-up. So that's usually a shorter conversation. You know, where do the remnants go? Okay, well, you know, this person is doing this fundraiser. I could donate and get the tax revenue. This person's doing this. I could do that. I could sell the prints at this, you know, whatever. And it's nice to kind of have your people there for that. But this one was pretty much all still there. So we got to have the conversation of where does this all go next? But that was the end. We'd like to see it at the Doll. I'd like to see it in other communities, especially places that are basically founded on the choo-choos, you know, places that wouldn't have existed without trains.
Yeah. Well, let me know when you get your proposal into the Doll, and I'll definitely give a nudge. Not that I have any influence.
Grease the wheels.
I'll grease the wheels of the train and get that thing moving. No, I think it'd be well recepted here, and I'd love to see it come here.
Cool.
It'd be great for the community.
Cool.
Thank you. Let me know. I'll see what I can do.
Thank you. The interest was big. It's just more of me now.
And so, I'll definitely share this episode with everybody at the Doll. I know the actual executive director of the Doll and the president of the Rapid City Arts Council, and I'll share it with them. Well, it's a small town, so. But yeah, I do know a lot of the people. So, but I'll share the episode so they'll know that you are truly interested.
Oh, so, thank you. That would be fantastic.
I'd be excited to see it.
All right. Well, great. Yeah. Truly appreciate it.
Yeah.
So you seem like, even though you've dealt with some serious stuff in the last year or so, you seem like you're a very optimistic person. 2021, feeling optimistic about it?
You bet your bibbies I am. It was too easy to be human. We had to figure this all out. We had to have a little bit of a challenge. It got really easy to be a person for a while. Sometimes without, you don't know who you are until you're tested. And sometimes the country doesn't know who it is until it's tested. And sometimes, you know, the power doesn't know what it is until it's tested. You got to test it. So I think, yes, collectively, we are ready for 2021. It is going to be better. And we've learned a lot, right? Like, we figured it out. We've got together. We're going to figure out how to do this with social distance. We'll figure out how to do this with social distance. We'll figure out. We did an art show with social distance. How did that even work? You know, 10 people at a time, in, out, no more than, you know, we figured it out. And if that doesn't signal humanity, that maybe being tested isn't so bad. Kind of shows you who you are. So yeah, yeah, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be the best year ever.
Most growth comes from when you're tested. If everything is hunky-dory and happy-go-lucky and you're never, you don't have the growth, the minute you're faced up against a wall that you have to adapt and overcome, you know, you have growth.
Yeah. Deepak Chopra says that. He says, if heaven is real, it would be hell. Because the closer you are to a creator, you're creating. That's where you're closest. And I thought that was the most brilliant thing. But you don't create when you're just happy. You create when you're tested, and you need an outlet, and you need to create in order to move through something. So yes, collectively we needed this, needed a challenge. We needed to find what was real and what wasn't. And you know, as long as everybody embraces that, we're all going to come together. It's going to be fine. Just turn off the news, everybody. Like, don't watch any more TV. I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't have a lot of time to do it. And that is awesome. It makes me a lot happier, I think. So if I have anything to say about everybody, just collectively shut off your television and we'll be all right. We're going to be all right.
Amy, thank you so much for spending time with us this evening. You talked about how time is precious, and it truly is. And as an artist and a mom, I really appreciate you taking time away from your work, time away from your family, to spend a couple hours with Wes and I this evening.
The pleasure is mine. I really enjoyed it.
You're a beautiful person, and I love you. This is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Well, you guys have a lovely evening. And yeah, we'll be in touch.
All right.
Sounds good.
See you in South Dakota. See you in Rapid City.
For the Tenet Podcast, this is Todd Pearson.
And I'm Wes Brown.
Have a great week.